It's Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. It's John McMullen. Welcome you to the 127th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 126 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's John www.johnmack13.com. My most recent piece for the Westchester Guardian is that website, www.westchesterguardian.com, and that's WESTCHESTERGUARDIAN. It includes the 192nd column in the Creative Disruption series. I hope you'll read the column, you'll listen to the radio show, and if desired, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. The next week's guest will be physicist and game developer William Volk. Then out to this show, the 127th in the series, as I mentioned, callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. My guest tonight, Steve McQuillan, was my guest on the very third episode of this show almost 2.5 years ago. Much has happened in both our lives since, as well as hopefully in the majority of this show. Steve also grew up in the same intersection of Manhattan, New York City that I did. He was slightly after me, but in the same general Irish Catholic Jewish environment. He has had a lengthy radio and television career as a reporter, commentator, and morning show host in New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, then now resides in Florida, where, among other things, he was regularly writing the blog, The Saloon Guy, when last we spoke. So let's reintroduce Steve McQuillan to the show. Good evening, and welcome, Steve.
Well, it's good to be here. I didn't realize I was only on the third show. I should have been more honored at the time. I wasn't. I apologize for that. And I just want to just correct one thing you said. I came considerably after you did in Inwood, not just a little after you did in Inwood. So.
Not that long.
I'm mocking you. I know you're contemporaries, right? Yeah, we're only about 7 or 8 years apart, probably.
I want to reintroduce you to our audience who were here 2 years ago and introduce you to those who weren't. So I'll start off with an important neighborhood question. How old were you when you had your first can of beer in Inwood Park?
So I'm going to say 16. I mean, that just seemed to be the logical time when I did that. I was a little slower to the party than others who were my contemporaries. But I'm sure it was right around 16. I am sure it was on the steps. It was the rite of passage of all of us in Inwood to meet your friends up on the steps and back in the handball courts and pop a couple of tins. Actually, it was probably a bottle. My good pal from Academy Street, Johnny O'Brien, used to call me and say, "Hey, come on, we're going to go up to the steps and have some L's and Zell's." And that was bottles of beer and pretzels, L's and Zell's. So I was probably 16, I would think, would be my first beer. I remember when I had my first drink in a bar.
Okay.
That was, was that the next question?
No.
That seems to be the logical one.
I wasn't going there yet. We used to drink up in the, near the basketball courts. On the on the path behind the flagpole, heading up the hill there,
right.
On the wall there. Where'd you grow up in the neighborhood? I grew up
on 213th Street. between Broadway and 10th Avenue. And it was, it's right across the street. When I was a real little kid, when I, like four or five years, and I do remember this, it was the Benedetto Farm, which you know, and maybe some of your listeners would know or would not know, I guess also. It was the last working farm on Manhattan Island. And then I remember, I believe it was Mary Benedetta would actually come door to door selling eggs. And
when Willie Lennon died, Father Divine was at the wake, and he told people that he always meant to apologize and to make restitution for when people used to jump over the fence to steal the fruit, but he never did.
Well, that's right. The Divines were, I'm going to get all the numbers messed up, so I probably shouldn't even try and get the numbers of the building. But they lived in the last building down the hill, right next to 10th Avenue, and it was Father Divine and the great Finbar Divine, who went on to be a distinguished police officer and most well-known for the man who led the New York City Emerald Society marching band. And I used to get such a big kick out of seeing Finbar with that big barrel chest of his and a handlebar mustache and just parading down Fifth Avenue on St. Patrick's Day. And then there was it Matty Divine was the other brother who I believe was in the FBI. Do I get that right or wrong, John?
Yeah, he was an FBI agent, and his claim to fame was he was on the front page of the Daily News with his hand on Fat Tony Solano's arm when he was arresting him. Matty's no longer with us. Matty and Frank Gilhooly, right. they were very close, and they were both on the FBI. The funny thing about
213th Street was not like almost any other street. In Manhattan, it was, you know, very first or second generation Irish, tons of children playing on the street at any time of day, after school, on Saturdays and Sundays. And, you know, it was one of those, you know, I hear about how creative young people are. And I think back about how we could with a bottle cap and a piece of chalk, create a game called Skullsy on the street and entertain ourselves for hours and hours, and how we can turn 213th Street between Broadway and 10th Avenue, the bottom half, the bottom part of the street is the elevated train. And we would turn the street into Yankee Stadium and play stickball. And if you were strong enough and good enough to hit one on the L, that was like an upper deck shot at Yankee Stadium. So I don't think young people have any more creativity than we did. We actually managed to entertain ourselves with far less, if you ask me.
It was one block long, four houses. There were more kids there than in Calcutta. And if you listen to the people that grew up in that one block, they say it was the greatest place that they could ever have grown up in. There was the Hollands, there was the McGoldricks, there was Vinnie Odetsky,
right.
there was the Johnsons, there was on and on and on and on.
Right, right, and younger families, the Corliss family, George and Bobby Corliss, they had eight or nine kids. And you know, the good thing, and this probably sounds like an old sod, you know, we're a couple of old-timers sitting here talking, but it really was like you had, 30 mothers and fathers. Because everybody did keep an eye out for everyone else's children, and nobody was hesitant to give you a little kick in the ass if you were if they saw you doing something stupid or misbehaving too. And if you didn't run to your parents and say, "Hey, Mr. Gorman gave me a kick in the butt," because you were just going to get another one. So there's no point in actually bringing it up.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to Good Shepherd. And get out in 1966 for good behavior. And then I went over to Cardinal Hayes for a couple of years, and there was a little misunderstanding about a crap can in the bathroom. And so I was not thrown out. No, was I expelled, but it was made clear to me that I probably wasn't welcome back from my junior year. And then I went over to, by that time I had already decided I was going to pursue a career in acting. And so my mother had said to me, all right, well, you got to just find something to do. You got to learn to do something. If you don't want to go to college and you want to go to acting school, I'll support that. But you got to find something to do. So I went to St. Helena's Business School. And wound up being the president of the student council because I was pretty much the only guy there who didn't have a record. And that's where my leadership skills developed.
I know that one of your early jobs was bartending. How did you get into that?
Well, that's, you know, and the guy who had been a guest, has been a guest on your show, I'd be willing to bet more than one time, is Chicky Donahue. And I had gone out to California to study acting and was working out there. And where the heck was I? I'm trying to think of how old I was. Well, no, this was right out of school. I was about 19 years old, and Chicky Donahue, along with a guy named Jerry O'Sullivan, had purchased the Doc Fiddlers, which had previously, and turned it into a place called the Red Barrel. And way before it was Doc Fiddlers, it was an old-time bar called Foster's. And Doc Fiddlers was a very popular hangout. The older people would go hang out in chambers across the street. It was on Hysham Street and Sherman Avenue. And some younger people my age, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, would go to Doc Fiddlers. And Chicky and Jerry bought it, and I was hanging out there. And, you know, Friday and Saturday nights, I was driving private, going to school, studying at the New York Academy of Theatrical Arts, and driving private cabs at night because I wasn't old enough to get a hack license. And doing that five nights a week and all day on Saturday so I could put myself to school and have money in my pocket. And one day, Chicky Donahue, you know, I was always a bit of a class clown. And Chicky grabbed me one day and said, hey, kid, can I talk to you outside? And I didn't really know Chicky very well at all, aside from, hi, Chick. You know, he owned the bar. How you doing, Chicky? That was it. So he said to me, hey, have you ever attended bar? So having studied acting, and they always tell you that when you go to an audition, you never say you can't do something. If they say, can you ride a horse? You say yes. If they say, can you ride a motorcycle? You say yes. And then in the period of time between that interview and actually doing it, you better learn how to do it. So when Chicky said to me, do you know how to tend bar? And I said, sure I do, absolutely. He goes, where'd you tend bar? And I went, well, you know, like house parties and stuff like that. And he went, here's the deal. We just built that back bar, that little service bar, probably about, you know, 10 people, 11 people can stand at it. And we're looking for somebody to put back there on Friday and Saturday nights. You want to give it a shot? And I said, sure, why not? And I'd be happy to do it. And so he said, all right, come in Friday night, come in a couple hours early, and we'll take you through everything and, you know, train you. So I did and went behind the bar and had a jolly old time. And Chicky said to me, there's a couple of rules. And rule number one is if you don't play that piano, if you don't put the money in the cash register, you're not going to be here long. So make sure I get mine. You're going to get your tips, but make sure I get mine. And so I did the best I could. You know, it wasn't really that tough. Nobody in those days, you didn't know how to make a Singapore sling or a grasshopper. It was pretty much vodka and soda, scotch and water, bottles of beer. I had two wines, red and white. I remember the prices. It was 65 cents for a Budweiser. It was 75 cents for a Heineken. It was 75 cents for a drink and 90 cents for a cold drink. And so I worked. I worked. Imagine that, huh? I mean, you can go out and have a good time for yourself for $10 in those days.
It's funny. My son's a TV writer on the West Coast, and before he went out to Hollywood, he wanted to have some kind of a skill. So he asked me if I get him the bartender job. So I called Cal McKinney in the Pipe Is Killed, and he bartended for her one summer on the weekends, and then he went off. He never had to bartend, but he did it was something to fall back on. So.
Well, this was the greatest education I ever had, to be quite honest with you. And much later in life, I don't want to get ahead. I want to stay focused here, and then we'll do this as you guide me through it. But there was one point when I was hosting a talk show, a morning TV show in San Francisco, and a critic said to me, you know, nothing, you haven't done anything like this in your career. You're a sportscaster, reporter. And I'm like, yeah, well, I know what I've done. Excuse me. And he said, what do you think has prepared you to actually be able to be a talk show host? And I said, well, I was a bartender. And he looked at me like I had two heads. I said, what does a bartender do? What does a bartender do? A bartender welcomes strangers into his establishment, makes them feel very comfortable by paying attention to them and talking to them and listening to them and entertaining them. And he does it, and his goal is to have them keep coming back to see him in that bar. So I did that very successfully as a bartender, so I think I'm totally qualified to be a talk show host. And he thought I was absolutely crazy. But I think it was the greatest education I ever had. I highly recommend it to everybody. Work in a restaurant. It really will give you a great insight into human nature. And you will have to, if you want to succeed and make some money in those places, you really will have to learn how to handle people. And sometimes you will be handling those people when they are at their worst. And that's really a good trait to have, a good skill to have.
What kind of an employee was Steve Chick?
Oh, he was pretty good. He was pretty good. I knew he was, he mentions he was going to acting school. Well, I didn't think he needed any schooling for that. As a matter of fact, he first came to my attention, the Paulus players used to hang out in Dots. As a matter of fact, that's one of the first things Jerry and I sponsored was the Paulus players. And Steve was with the Paulus players. And he was very active with the Paulus players, as I remember. And we built that back bar. And he was a young, big, strapping, young, handsome man. That's what they told me at the time. I didn't know what a handsome man would look like when I was that age. At 75,
well, who
I know
told
what a
who lied
man
to you?
Looked
who
like.
Told you that?
Probably one of the girls. So that's why, and when I asked him, I wouldn't have asked him where did he work, or, I would have said, did you ever attend bar before? But I knew anybody who grew up in Inwood had the makings of a bartender in their genes. It wouldn't take more than a Friday and a Saturday night behind the stick, as we used to call it, and he'd be a pro. And that's essentially how he turned out.
Steve mentioned that before there was the Red Barrel, there was the Doc Fiddler's. Do you remember who owned that, Steve?
Oh, it was Tommy Coughlin and Richie Shinnick.
Just say about that, Rich.
Oh, Cheech. Jesus Christ. Cheech. Cheech.
Richard, are you there?
I remember it being Brian.
Yeah, it was Brian Forster. Who's calling in from the 203 area code?
Tommy Hanlon.
Huh?
Tom Hanlon.
Oh, hello, Tom Hanlon.
Is that Richie Shinnick?
No, that was Richie. I thought you were Richie. Steve, do you remember Tom Hanlon?
Yeah, I do. How are you, Tom?
What do you say? What do you know? I'm enjoying listening.
Tom was known in just about every bar in New York State and foreign countries. So
I knew every bartender from the Statue of Liberty to 218th Street, unfortunately. Don't be married to me.
All right.
Tell you, Tom, I appreciate your contributions to the effort.
I'll put you back listening, Tom. And then you wound up, after a while, up in the place owned by a famous Inwood bar owner, Jack Chambers, in his last local bar, The Fireplace. How'd that happen?
That happened. Well, I'd been working for the Red Barrel for a while, and Rory Finn had actually taken it over. And it was almost the same situation as when Chickie gave me my shot at the Red Barrel. I was dating a girl. I probably shouldn't say her name, so there's no reason to do that. But we used to go on dates. I'd take her up to the Chambers fireplace, and, you know, so we get out of the neighborhood and, you know, we could just be by ourselves. And so I got to know Jack. I certainly had known him from working across the street, because I would go in there from, I lived in the building right over Chambers, so I would go in there and see Eddie Callahan all the time. And so it was the same thing. I just kind of hung out there, and one day Jack called me outside and said, "Are you happy down there in the Red Barrel?" I said, "I've been there a long time. It's kind of changing. Why?" He goes, "I need a 5-night-a-week guy up here." And I was still only working 2 or 3 nights a week down there on the weekends. He goes, "I need a 5. I want to give you the job main guy here 5 nights a week. And so I, you know, I didn't even think about it. I said, "Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to do that." So so I worked for Jack for a couple of years up there, I guess.
That was very different from Chambers. It was the Goldmine. Didn't he have entertainment there?
Yeah, it was a dinner house. I mean, it was a full restaurant. It was, a dinner house, and he had, I guess, a few nights a week he had live entertainment. I remember he had a jazz band, and one of their favorite songs was, I can't remember the name of the song, but one of the lines was, "X-Lax and Lima Beans makes the biggest mess you ever seen." And it was... But that was, you know, it was a real peaceful joint, you know. But by that time, Inwood had started to change a little, and, you know, one of the skills you had to have to be a bartender was be able to get over the bar and break up fights. And in the early days when Chickie still there?
Yeah,
I'm here.
Yeah, you know, in the early days, we really didn't have that. You know, we had a couple of bad incidences at the Red Barrel, but you know, for the most part, everybody knew each other, everybody liked each other. It was like being part of a club. You know, there was just the occasional argument. Later on, after a while, you know, after Chickie had left and Jerry had left, and it got, you know, my boxing skills improved greatly, and I really didn't ever intend for that to happen. So working up at Chambers was like a grown-up place for me. I guess that would be the better way for me to describe it.
Yeah,
Jack was
a magnificent guy.
I like Jack a lot.
I did too, and I liked his brother Sam a lot too. Sam was a U.S. Marshal, and he used to work the back bar than Chambers.
Right.
One of the Inwood locals began singing up in at the Red Barrel, didn't she?
Are you thinking of Sheila?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was, by the way, that was the girl I used to run away up to the fireplace with.
Oh.
Sheila Mannix Devaney. Yes. And she didn't start singing at the Red Barrel. No, she started.
I meant the fireplace.
Yeah, I think she did. Yeah. She probably did sing at the fireplace, but she also sang with Patty. Help me, Chickie. The Green Alligator. Patty McCormick.
Patty McCormick's
place.
Broadway.
Yeah, right. Yeah. She.
Sheila, what was it like going out with Steve then?
Oh,
well,
no, I didn't
Steve.
Mean to blow the whistle on you, honey.
That's quite all right. No shame in that. Hi, Chick. Hi,
how
Steve.
Are you, Sheila?
I'm very good. I remember you singing to me in 6/16. They try
oh,
to
I
tell
tried
us
everything
we're too young.
You, I tried everything. Nothing worked
oh, my.
For Chickie.
You
I was
are the funniest.
Steve.
You are the funniest guy ever. I am really enjoying listening to you. And Steve, you sound wonderful. You're doing great. Sounds
thank you,
like.
Sheila. So are you.
Yeah, I am.
You,
yeah. I yeah, had
are,
a
you,
little...
are you singing anymore?
No, honey, in the shower. Last time
well,
I sang was at my daughter's wedding. I sang at all my kids' weddings, you know. Hi, John. How are you?
I'm terrific, Sheila. Tell us about singing at the fireplace.
Well, I mean, that was kind of a great experience. That all came about... we were really a theater group Theater 9, I think, and we were doing theater on the road, and Jack Chambers let us do Charlie Brown there. And actually, Steve, that's where I thought I met you, was at...
No, I remember. I'll never forget the night I met you.
Well, sorry, I have. So refresh my memory. sorry. Was it at the Red Barrel? I mean, then
yeah,
we
it was
were
at the Red Barrel. It was at
late
the Red
night.
Barrel.
That was we were late night edition. Was Patty Walsh? That was a great band. And unfortunately, I left for whatever reason, and the band broke up. But we were really, it was a great sound. Patty was an incredible musician. And,
was that the band, Sheila, was that the band that you would have been with at St. Gabriel's that night?
No.
That you won that going
no.
No?
Oh, God, John, I've been around. That was Company. You know, there was a lot of, we were reinventing ourselves all the time, different names, different people. The best band really was this late night edition, and that was Patty Walsh and Billy O'Connor, Jimmy Franco, and Michael, my ex. He was the drummer. But the band that played at the Mount for the 75th anniversary for Good Shepherd was we were called Company. And, Steve, I think you introduced the band at that time.
I did. That's right. I was sort of like the MC for the event,
yes.
as I recall.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Sheila, my favorite, though, do I get it? My favorite was when you played, I don't remember his last name. He was an African-American fella named Eddie, who
John
was
Hendricks.
A spitting image of help me, Fats Domino.
Oh, my God, Steve, you're
and
going
you
way back.
It,
that's when I started.
It, right, you sang at Joe's
Pier
52. Joe's Pier 52.
Oh, my. Yes, well, that's when it all started. This guy,
yeah.
Remember, well, you and I were there, I think, and I thought he was fabulous, and, you know, I said I knew somebody who owned a bar, which was Doc Fiddler's, and he really was terrific. And when he was going out of town or whatever the story was, and he called me when he came back and he said that he was looking for a singer. I don't know where I had the nerve to even say it, but he said he was looking for a singer. And I said, well, I sing. And he said, really? So meanwhile, I don't even want to tell you about that venture, because he had an apartment down in 168th Street near Yankee Stadium. And I would go down, that's how badly I wanted to do this. I would go down there to rehearse with him in not a very good neighborhood, to say the least. Matter of fact, one night when I was leaving, it was maybe about 9:30 at night, and I was in the elevator, and some guy got on the elevator, a man of color, and I don't know. You know how you just feel in your gut something is bad's going to happen? So I got my Irish up, I guess, and I put my hands in my pocket and just pointed it towards him like as if I had a gun. What the hell was I thinking? I swear to God. I swear to God. I figured, well, if I'm going down, you're going with me. And I didn't have a gun, but I was going to kick him you know where. However, he kind of backed up a little bit because I didn't get intimidated. But I think it was very risky, the things I did back then. But I wanted to sing so much that, you know, you don't think about those things when you're young, you know, and the opportunity comes, I guess. I don't know.
Steve, did you always want to go into broadcasting or just wanted to act? Then how did you
I wanted to
get into
the broadcasting thing. Yeah, the broadcasting thing happened fortuitously, but it was kind of accidental. My dad got ill, and I was studying out in San Francisco at the American Conservatory Theater, and somebody had to take care of him. My older brother was in the Navy, had two kids. He couldn't, you know, he was on the other side of the country too. So I came back to take care of him. I got a job at a joint on Second Avenue called Court Street, and it's really funny. It's, you know, everything is all connected. The guys who helped me get into Court Street was Tommy Dolady. He was a bartender up in at the Piper's Kilt. He said, go down and see this guy, George. And I went to see him. He gave me a job. And a guy named Jim Kerr, who was the morning man on WPLJ, would get paid to be there on Friday and Saturday nights. And Jim and I got to be very friendly. And one night He asked me what I was doing after we closed at 4 in the morning. And I said, going after hours, joined up on 86th Street, that Louis Cavanaugh, Sheila, Louis Cavanaugh.
Oh, God, yes, yeah.
Another great mutual friend of ours.
Yes, and Maureen,
He was running, and so I went up there, and he said, can I go with you? And I said, oh, Jim, I don't think it's your kind of place. You know, there's gambling, and it's, you know, I don't think you really should be there. And he's like, no, I want to go. So I go, and I go over to the bar, and I start talking to a couple of people I know, and we're about 15 minutes into this thing, and somebody taps me on the shoulder and says, your buddy's in big trouble. Two guys are going to kick that. Two guys are going to rough him up. So I went over there, and I don't want to get into anything macho, but let's just say righteousness prevailed. And Louis came up to me, and he said, everything okay? And he looked at me, looked at the other two fellas at the bottom of the stairs, and I said, everything's fine. And then Jim and I became pals, and he said, hey, I got a great idea. I know you're frustrated a couple of days later, because I know you're frustrated you can't pursue your career while you're helping to take care of your dad. But how about if you come on my show and talk about sports? You're a sports maniac, and we'll call you Steve the Bartender, and you won't get any money, but at least, you know, let's see how this turns out for you. So turned out pretty darn good.
That's how it all started, huh?
That's how it started. Yeah. That's how I was Steve the Bartender for 2 years. And
wow.
I know that you led.
It all started with Chickie Donahue, to be honest with you. You make him a bartender. That's how
everything
all started.
Everything starts with Chickie Donahue.
I give Chickie all the credit for it, because if that day he called me outside and, you know, said, hey, we want to give you a shot behind the bar. That I point so many things. I can point to that day was the reason I met Sheila. I was always trying to impress Sheila. We both had our interest in theater.
You came to see me in a show that we had done. The name of the show was Company, actually. And you and Louis Farragher came up to see it in Riverdale.
The great Louis Farragher.
I don't know
Farragher.
If you remember that. Yeah.
But you and I used to go to Elaine's a lot or occasionally.
Yes, because I worked right next door in Dresner's.
Right, and that's how I got to know Elaine. And once again, I mean, I'm 19, 20, 21 years old. And,
yeah,
you
that's
know,
a
she
little sick,
me...
so shut up, okay?
She treated me like a son for, you know, the 40 years I know her until she passed away 5 years ago, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it really is. Everything in your life is linked, you know?
A lot of nice memories, have to say.
I know that you later replaced Howard Cosell as WABC AM sports director. Was he as disliked at the station as the later report said he was?
He was feared. Howard, I liked Howard. Howard and I got along. I had no issue with him, but he was feared. I mean, he would, you know, he'd lose his temper at times, and usually – well, I don't know that you're ever right to lose your temper and belittle people, but it was only when things went bad. He didn't do it just because he didn't get enough mayonnaise on his tuna sandwich. But I'll give you a funny Howard story. He had a beautiful redheaded production assistant named Marty McGarrigle, who had just come out of St. Mary's Notre Dame sister school and moved to New York, and she was actually living in with the nuns on 79th Street. And we were flirting with each other, so I asked her out, and I was going to take her out to dinner on a Friday night. And Friday afternoon, I was at my desk, and the phone rings, and I answer it, and I hear, hello, Steve, this is Howard. Hi, Coach, how you doing? I'm doing fine, Steve. However, I understand that you are taking out young Miss McGarrigle tonight. Well, yes, I am, Coach, I am. Well, I hope you understand that your future at the American Broadcasting Company depends on your conduct this evening.
She probably
don't worry, Coach.
Say
I'll
that.
Be a gentleman.
Very cute.
No, I get along with Cosell great. I really had no issues with
him. You anchored the network's coverage of the 84 Winter and Summer Olympics. What was that like?
It was the hardest work you'll ever do. I mean, we went to Sarajevo, the Olympics in 84 in Sarajevo, Yugoslavia. And my favorite story there is I couldn't find a beer. They drink this warm stuff called pivo. And Chick, you are a merchant marine. Did you ever get to Yugoslavia?
No, I don't, never. It was a communist country when I was on the ships, and we didn't go to communist countries.
Well, let me tell you, this was when it finally snowed. They had to delay the downhill skiing for a number of days. When it finally snowed, so they could actually hold the events, the way they packed the snow in on the mountain was to get the Yugoslavian army to march up and down the mountain. Because they didn't have any machinery to pack the snow. But I was dying. I couldn't drink. The beer was just horrible. It's called Pivo, and it's a family show, so I won't tell you what I think Pivo means. But it was terrible, one of our guys was a great Canadian broadcaster named Don Chevrier, who's done every sport in the world. And Chevy says, "Hey, there's a little party tonight at Labatt House. Do you want to go with me?" I said, "Yeah, sure, I'll go." And of course, they had beer, Canadian beer, but it was beer. And so I made friends with some people, and one of the guys said to me, "Hey, you take a couple of cases with you." So because I had some bad habits, I had a driver assigned to me in Yugoslavia. So I went outside, I got the drivers, "You come with me." And we grabbed about four cases each, or whatever we could carry, whatever a grown man can actually carry. And we put them in the car, and I went out and put them on my balcony out there and prayed for snow. And finally it snowed because we had no refrigerators in the apartments we were given. And so that's how I got through the 1984 Winter Olympics in Sarajevo, Yugoslavia, with thanks to the Labatt people.
What caused you to move from network radio and sports to directing to local TV in New York?
I wanted to do television. And that's, it's like why Willie Sutton robbed the banks. That's where the money is. And when I had the chance to work at Channel 5, I jumped at it. I'm a performer. That's what I do. And so when I had the chance to go and back up Bill Mazur, be number two to Bill Mazur at Channel 5, so I thought it was great. And the thing is, though, John, it was probably the happiest period of my life because I had three jobs. I was still on the when I first started at Channel 5, I was still on our ABC radio network on about 110, 120 radio stations around the country. I was on WPLJ in the mornings. I'd come back to be on WPLJ with Jim Kerr. And then I would go and I would anchor the sports segment of the noon news and spend the day doing a report for the 10 o'clock news. And I've never been happier. That was pretty much the greatest. When all of that overlapped, it was like about a year and a half. So that was the greatest year and a half of my life. I was never happier than doing that because I was performing constantly. That was great.
You were with Channel 5 before the news company bought it. I know that the New York Post staff had a great deal of culture shock when it was acquired. Was it similar shock at Channel 5?
Well, yeah, but once again, just being the luckiest son of a gun in the world, there was a bar across the street called the Racing Club. And I would go there for, medicinal purposes on occasion. And I got to know these three guys one day at the bar, and they just start chatting me up. And they kind of knew me, and I didn't know who they were. It was two Aussies and an American. And it turned out that they were Rupert Murdoch's guys that he had planted there to watch prior to the transition from going from Metro Media to Fox. He had planted them there. So I kind of, would see them there. We'd have a drink together. We'd have a couple beers, and I'd tell them a few stories, and we'd have a laugh, and I'd recommend places for them to go. And so we became pals. So when Murdoch took it over, probably about a week after he officially took over the station, I got a call from that I had to go up to Ian Ray's office, and Ian was one of the guys. I thought I was out. I thought I was getting fired. I figured I've finally been found out. And I go up there, and they say, "Hey, we're doing a show, and we want you to you're going to be the only guy we're going to take from Channel 5 to do it. And Maury Povich is going to do it. We're taking him from Washington." And I said, "What's it going to be called?" And they said, "We don't know." And I said, "What kind of show is it going to be?" They said, "We don't know." And I said, well, yeah, I'd like a little information if I'm going to leave this gig I have. And they pretty much looked at me and said, well, Mr. Murdoch wants you to do it. I said, all right, well, I called my agent, and he said, yeah, no, you're going to do it. You know, Rupert's in for the long haul here, so you're going to do it. And that show was A Current Affair, which turned out to be a groundbreaking show in television history because it was the first tabloid television show.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Then you were on the move. Then Inside Edition.
Yeah, I was kind of on the move. It was fun. I mean, hey, they gave me a platinum credit card, a platinum American Express card, and they never asked me to fill out an expense account. And so I never asked them for a raise. I was afraid. I was afraid they'd find me out. So they love me. They thought that was great. He works hard and he doesn't ask for more money. In the meantime, I'm buying suits at Barney's on their platinum card.
Oh my God.
Hey, Chick, you're an expert on such things. Is the statute of limitations up on that? Can I still get prosecuted?
Oh, you're safe. You're safe there, Steve. By the way, they knew everything that you were doing. That's why they gave you the credit card and told you, you know, they'll fill out any forms.
Don't put anything in writing.
Now, the Inside Edition then took you off to L.A. and then to San Francisco, and then you went back
to
radio.
The Inside Edition, some producers from A Current Affair were given a wheelbarrow full of money by the King brothers, Michael and Roger King. To start Inside Edition. And this is probably after the 3.5-4 years of A Current Affair being on. By then it was a huge hit. It was doing really well. And you know, the funny thing about performers is, you know, you really want the show to be good, but you really hate it when your role gets cut down. Now, when we first went on the air, there were only four reporters. There was me, Cora Ann Mahalik, who actually was been a news anchor in New York now for quite a while, a woman named Mary Hughes, and David Lee Miller, who's still a reporter for Fox News Channel. But as the show grew and became more popular, your roles diminished. You literally have to fight to get your stories on the air. And that was something that I didn't really like. So they let me do a pilot for my own show, and it was called Sports Pub, where it was a combination Cheers and Cheers, but it was with a talk show. Like, we had regular characters. We had the bartender and the waitress and me were the regular characters, but the ball players and sports writers who came into the bar, we would do a chat show with them. We would just, you know, talk to them about interview them. And so we did the pilot, and everybody loved the pilot, and I actually got told I should hire a staff, and we were going to run it on Sunday nights at 10:30 after the 10 o'clock news. And all of a sudden I get a phone call, stop, don't hire anybody. Barry Diller, who was the running Fox at the time, wants to try out another show, but that show is going to fail. And once that show fails, then we're going to come back and you could do Sports Pub. And I said, well, okay, fine. That show they used instead of my show was Cops. And I'm still waiting for it to fail here 26, 27 years later. It's still there.
Yeah.
So when an opportunity came for me to go to Inside Edition, I did. And once again, that was, you know, not to be mercenary, but sometimes they just make you an offer you can't refuse. And so I went over there, and I was with them for a couple of years, went out to L.A. and helped open up their L.A. bureau.
And then you went to San Francisco, and then you went back to radio. Now for some new stuff, with this unbelievable, bizarre political campaign unfolding, do you miss being on regular radio and TV?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I think that's why I mouth off on Facebook and Twitter a lot, is because I do have that, you know, instinct and the you know, somehow they turn the actor into a news guy. And so the newsman in me, you know, really gets angry at the fact that when I see people interviewed like Donald Trump and Cruz, that they're just, you know, swallowing their stuff wholesale. you know, you can, if I was sitting across from Donald Trump doing an interview with him, which I have, by the way, on many occasions, and I would not let him get away with his stuff. And they do, and it infuriates me. I mean, there's not a good journalist, Maury or any of the guys I worked with in my lifetime, would let this guy get away with the things he says he's going to do. And I'm, so that makes me angry. I do get a little frustrated I can't be part of that. And what really makes me angry is that the populace, the voting public, seems to be swallowing this because the people who were in the position I was in, the news business, aren't educating them and telling them, look, he can't support 11 million people. You just cannot do it. He can't build a wall. First off, geographically, there's areas you can't put a wall. And so there's, you know, there's so much he cannot do.
And even if he that, could, he couldn't get Mexico to pay for it.
He's not going to get Mexico to pay for it. Hey, look, for example, every illegal alien here. Now, great, it's big chest thumping. I'm throwing them all out. That's great. And he's pandering to the worst in people when he says that. But the truth of the matter is, for you to deport somebody, you have to arrest them. And once they get arrested, this still is the United States of America. They get, they're assigned an attorney. And that attorney can take them through three. If the judge says they got to go, they're here illegally, they got to go, you get two appeals. And so the only people you're not going to be, the cost of actually deporting one person is like, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. So you're not going to do that. It's going to cost you billions of dollars to deport these people. It would be much more pragmatic and to actually assimilate them than it would be to throw them out. And the fact that the general populace isn't being educated to these facts really upsets me. Yeah, so I do get frustrated. Yes, I do.
Go ahead, Sheila.
John, I was just going to say that I think that Donald Trump is saying things that people want to hear. Is he qualified to be the president of our great nation? No, he is not. And it's all this rhetoric that he is saying is what people are feeling. I mean, I don't like to get into political conversations. We all have our very own opinions about things and whatever affiliation we belong to. But, no, I don't think, please God, that this man does not become the president of this great country. That's all I can say.
You know, Sheila, I agree with you. I understand. He does pay to the frustrations of,
yes,
of
yes,
the public.
Does.
But without having a plan, without having a plan that you can actually do.
He has a huge plan. I mean, everything he says, it's huge.
And it's going to be the best. I'm well aware of that.
It's horrible.
But, you know, the truth of the matter is many things he says he's going to do just cannot be done. It can't be done legally.
Right, exactly.
You can't throw out anchor babies. I'm sorry, we do have a constitution. You can't do it.
No.
It has been challenged in the courts, and the courts time and time again have ruled in favor of the child who was born
but
in the United States as being an American citizen.
How sad is that everybody's buying into this, that they're listening to him.
Every time he says something more and more outrageous, his ratings go up. That hesitation about getting into political discussion is a never-stop chick. Chick, comment on Donald Trump, will you?
Well, Steve, you've seen changes in media, whatever. It's ratings. They tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
They admit it. Every time they put Donald on there, their ratings goes up. Donald knows that game. He's playing the game. He's playing an inside game there. And they don't care. They're not into educating. Other than public service, PBS, other than them, the other networks, it's... it was appropriate that GE owned NBC and GE operated NBC. It's capitalism. It's money. It's no longer the media and the independent journalists educating. You used that word a couple of times, educating the American people. They don't want to educate the American people. They want to do what every other company wants to do, make money from the American people. And Donald Trump is making money for, they don't have to create shows. They put Donald Trump and this circus that's been going on for the last 9 months on 7 days a week, almost 24 hours a day. It's sad.
It is very sad.
Yes, it is. I agree.
Yeah, I think we're all on the same page with that, Chick. I can't, and it's one of the reasons why, you know, while John's question to me was, do I miss it, there's a frustration on my part that I would like to be part of the conversation. But to be honest with you, there's no place for guys like me anymore because, you know, I would do it the way I think is the right way to do it. And if they said, well, you can't offend Mr. Trump because he might not come back on our air.
Well,
well,
I will say to you, Steve,
I think
you are very outspoken in what you had to say on Facebook, and I give you a lot of credit for that because a lot of people won't take that chance. So I do give you a lot of credit for that. You speak your mind.
Well, you know, it's easy to have no fear when you have nothing to lose.
Well, yeah, that's true for all of us, isn't it now?
Steve, yeah. You've been in Florida for a while. Has it been long enough to form opinions on Senator Rubio and Governor Bush? And if so, to let us know what they are.
Well, Governor Bush was a really good governor here. I mean, he was, you know, wildly adored here in Florida, and he did a good job. Marco Rubio is, you know, he's fledgling. He was the Speaker of the House. He was a state senator from Miami, so my path did not cross with him, and I don't believe he did anything extraordinary in his political career. I think his political career at this point in his life actually mirrors Barack Obama's. You know, they had they were elected officials, they were state senators and elected to the U.S. Senate, but really didn't do much. You know, as far as anything you would point at and say, that's what he's responsible for. So I'm not a big I'm kind of off. If you ask, if from a personal point of view, I'm off first term senators as president. I don't think it's on the job. It should be an on the job learning experience. And I was, you know, I like the governors, and there's only one governor left. And unfortunately, he's just horrible at debates. He just gets beat up at every debate. But when you listen to John Kasich give a speech, when you see him interviewed, you realize he is a man who has accomplished a lot in his life. And he, you know, he's a Republican governor, a very, very popular Republican governor. He got 60% of the vote in an incredibly blue state like Ohio, which if the Republicans have any hope at all to take back the White House, they need Ohio. So,
well, the interesting thing
that's
about
the guy I would look at.
The interesting thing about Kasich is he seems so happy and uplifting. All the other people they were involved in assassinating each other. Now, the Rubio, unlike Obama, Obama never said he didn't like his job as senator. Rubio said the reason he doesn't show up is he doesn't like the job. What if he gets elected?
Well, he doesn't like
president?
It because he doesn't feel like he can get anything done.
But what if
you know, I mean, there's a qualification here. I'm not defending the guy, but you know, I think if you sign up for the job, you know, I think it shows it's a lot about a person's character. I criticized Barack Obama about it in that time. I'll criticize Rubio about it now. You know, Barack Obama asked the people of Illinois for a job. They gave it to him. He didn't do it. The people of Florida gave a job to Marco Rubio. He's not doing it. I think that does that's a telling quality in a person.
But what if he didn't like the job as president because it was too frustrating to deal with Congress? Would he stop showing up there too, or would that was not good common sense to be quoted that. Chick, you've been in Florida for a while. What do you think about these two guys?
Well, I think Bush is. Everybody says he was a good governor. I wasn't around here when he was a good governor. I do remember his participation in that when some woman was dying of cancer and the husband wanted to turn the the machine off or something. And
Terry Schiavo. Her name was Terry Schiavo.
Yep.
It was political theater. That it was, as we would have said in Doc Fiddle, was bull. I won't say the last word, but he comes from of the family. The father was a genuine war hero. His brother was a wannabe war hero, and I think it was a farce that he should have run in the first place. I didn't think he was qualified at all. It must be a dozen years since he's been the governor here. But anyway, that's my Democratic trade unionist reaction to a Bush. Any Bush. Okay?
I thought the stupid thing was why give Democrats another reason to run against George W. Bush?
It was
unwise to give Democrats, and oddly enough, who knew, to actually give other Republican candidates the opportunity to run against George W. Bush.
Moving to the Democrats. Go ahead.
The day before yesterday, I had 9 sandhogs, retirees and snowbirds. We had lunch somewhere around here, Delray, and I'm the political director. So they said, what do you think about all of this and everything? They said, would you support Bernie? I said, I'll support any Democrat. I don't want to vote for Bernie because I don't think Bernie could actually win. And if he could win, he wouldn't get anything done. But that's my personal opinion. But as a trade unionist, I want somebody who's going to go in there and fix the Supreme Court decisions. I want somebody to go in there and make it truly free to join a union in the United States. The only thing you get from joining a union in the United States now is you get fired. And by the time the court process catches up with it, it's a cost, that's all. But meanwhile, you're out on the street. But anyway, don't preach that. I did say any Democrat today against the Republican Party that is trying to prove that government shouldn't function. They don't want government to function. And they're trying to prove that they're right. Government is the cause of all problems, so it shouldn't function. I would vote for the Reverend Al if he was the Democratic candidate against any Republican.
How do you read the Democrats there, Steve? Bernie and Hillary.
I got to tell you, I like Bernie. I probably stand in a entire polar opposite to everything he does, but I do appreciate the way he's running his campaign. I like the fact that he's not getting down into the mud. He's not name calling. He's actually taking the high road, and he's speaking about issues. Now, I personally, being somebody who's a little, I consider myself a centrist, but I'm probably a little right of centrist. I subscribe to Winston Churchill's theory that when you're 25, if you're not a liberal, you have no heart. And if you're 50 and you're not a conservative, you have no brain. So I'm probably a little right of center. But I don't agree with anything he says, but I do like the way he's running his campaign, and I appreciate it. But I also think that, the media is dropping the football when it comes to Bernie Sanders, because once again, he's promising things that you probably can't do. And you have to say, Mr. Sanders, how are you going to pay for everybody's college education? Tell me how you are going to make college education free. And the truth of the matter is the only answer he has is, well, I'm going to raise taxes on the 1%. Well, you know what? While the 1% do control an exorbitant amount of our economy, you can keep taxing them until they bleed. It's still not going to be enough to send every person in this country to college. So anyway, my read. I think, folks, to be really honest with you, I think that it's almost a fait accompli that we're going to have President Hillary Clinton.
The only major candidate that is known New York or Florida ties is Ted Cruz. It seems that he has no friends in the Senate service. How could he help to bring the country together if the people that he works with now hate him.
Well, no, I'm with you there. I wouldn't. You wouldn't get me voting for Cruz. I'm in one of those perplexing situations, telling you everything I've just told you about my political leanings, and I wouldn't vote for Trump or Cruz. And I don't believe in living by an ideology. I believe in living by my instincts and my personal life experience and the knowledge I've accumulated in my life. And that's how I'm going to vote. And I'm not going to be one of those Republicans who, well, I'll vote for Trump, I'll hold my nose, I'll vote for Trump. No, I'm telling you right now, I'll never vote for Donald Trump, and I'll never vote for Cruz.
Me either.
You know, that's just it's not on the agenda. It's not on my calendar. Hey, Chuck, I didn't know you were back. You were down here. Let's have lunch.
Yeah, sure.
All right, listen, my friends, I'm going to say goodbye. It was really great speaking with you, Steve and Chick. It's always interesting listening to you. And thank you, John, for inviting me in. And
thank
you,
Sheila.
I hope you're all doing well, and hope we cross our paths one day.
That'll be delightful.
Yes,
now,
it will.
Sheila?
Yes, honey.
Sheila, before you go, I have to tell you, I went to the public supermarket down here this afternoon, just before.
Was there a picture of me there?
No.
Okay.
But you remind me so much of, I know, the building you lived in, and I got a half a pound of Boar's Head bologna, and I got a half a pound of liverwurst. They didn't have any hard rolls, so I had to take Jewish rye.
So you used to get that in Jones and McGrath, right?
That's right. right downstairs.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Well, you know, the last show that I listened to of yours, John, Chick was talking about just so many, reminiscing about so many stories of Inwood. And it was really such a delight. I sat here laughing my butt off because I thought you were so funny. And you always were. Really, really happy to see that you're doing well. And, Steve, I follow you on Facebook, so, you know, we're in touch that way. And I don't know, John, I have to give you a lot of credit how you've kept the Inwood connection going. It's really been awesome. You know,
it really has, John. You're
you know,
you've
done
guest.
A great thing. Yes, you really have. So
thank you, Sheila.
And with that, I want to say God bless everybody, and I hope we do run into each other. Okay.
Okay. Be well.
Good night,
thank you,
guys.
God bless, Sheila.
Yes. You too. Take care now.
Bye.
But John, I know that my goodbye is not going to be any more gracious than that. So what are we? What are we just? Do we have more to talk about? Do you want to keep
I got
going?
A couple more, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
One more New Yorker. Do either of you think that Mayor Mike's going to come in? And if he does, what does it mean?
Go ahead, Chick.
Well, Mike can only come in if you have someone like a Cruz and a Bernie running. Complete chaos. Either communism or, you know, complete nuts. But I don't see any way Mike could be elected. I'd love to see Mike elected. He'd be a pragmatic businessman who appreciates government and sees that government can help people. And God knows a lot of people need help. But it ain't going to happen. It simply isn't going to happen. Quite frankly, I like the idea of Hillary and Trump running.
Those will be some interesting debates, huh?
Oh, yeah, but, you know, I know what Hillary's programs will be. I know she'll make what progress is possible at that time. I know she'll do a good thing with the Supreme Court. And Trump, let's make a deal. I can make a deal.
Steve,
he's
the
not
last...
an ideologue.
Steve, what do you think about Mike? Does he come in or not?
I agree.
What do you mean?
Chick, I think he would only come. I think he's pretty much said, or at least through surrogates, he has said that if it would be Bernie and Trump, he would come in.
Okay.
But I don't think that he would want to get in and spend the money and go through all the effort. And, you know, it is a painstaking effort to run for a national office like that if he's going to have to run against Hillary, because, you know, that machine is going to be a little bit too strong. You're not going to be able to put a dink in that. Unless the FBI indicts her, which I think we all know is not going to happen. But
when last you and I spoke on a completely different thing, you were involved in independent TV productions, but now you've moved into real estate sales. How did that happen?
It happened because I've grown very fond of a couple of things in my life, John, like living indoors and eating. To be honest with you, I just, you know, the TV production, like, I think everybody who's been in a business for over 30 years, you see how it changes, and then you have to make the judgment, is this changing in a manner that I can live with? And the way the industry was changing, and even on the production level, I just totally lost interest in being part of it. So I spent a year not doing anything, and that pretty much drove me crazy. And I found myself watching these shows on Flip and Flop and How to Flip a House and House and Garden TV, because a friend of mine, Nancy Glass, produces a bunch of those shows. I worked on a couple. And all of a sudden, I just found myself with this great interest in real estate. So I know a couple who owns a very prominent real estate company here in Palm Beach. It's called Linda Gary Real Estate. And Linda and her husband, Michael, are friends of mine. And I went to meet with them. And I said, well, you know, what's the process? How would I do this? And they said, well, this is what you got to do. You got to go get a license. And once you do that, you see that desk right in the corner there? That's yours. I said, you're kidding me. I could start right here with you right at the top. And they were like, absolutely, Steve. That'll be your desk if you get a license. And so I did. And I'm really enjoying it. It's not unlike anything else I've ever done. You know, it's meeting strangers and trying to make them feel comfortable with me. That's really what it is.
At that time, when we talked the last time, you're also very active with the Saloon Guy blog, but you kind of let that get dormant. How come?
Well, I had somebody, and John, you've written a number of books, and Chicky should write one.
Chicky is writing one.
You are
Chicky
writing
is
one.
Writing.
I hope so. Yeah. I hope you remember how to spell my last name. But
well,
I
like to say I have 70,000 words down already.
Well, good for you. And it's not an easy process to go through. Anyway, I was writing all the stories on the Saloon Guy, and a friend of mine in the industry, a publisher, said, don't give these stories away. You're going to want them in the book. If you decide one day that you're actually going to sit down and write a book, then everybody's going to know these stories. So that's why I kind of backed off on the Saloon Guy stuff.
Steve, you may know Chicky's co-author, Joanna Malloy from the Daily News.
Who is it?
Joanna Malloy.
Oh, yeah, sure. She wrote the Daily News version of Page Six for a while.
With Russian Malloy. It was Russian
Malloy.
Russian
Malloy, right. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, good for you, Chick.
Now, a question I asked you the last time, any reflections on growing up in Inwood and your life?
Well, everything I am is because I was there and because I knew people like Chicky Donahue and Sheila Maddox. I didn't want to tell his story while she was on to him, because I know that I think it would have embarrassed her a bit. But when Sheila and I were dating, I was working up at the fireplace, and I was, the acting thing was kind of on a back burner here. I was just working five nights, and I was going to auditions when I can. And I was actually directing plays at the age of 21 for the Paulist Players. But I was kind of had, you know, thinking that one of these days I'm going to want to get married and have kids. So I took the Yonkers Cops test. Sheila found out, I didn't tell her, but she found out through somebody else. And she said, you're crazy. You've got a gift. You've got an ability. You've got to go perform. You can't be a Yonkers cop. You can't do that. And so people like that in my life who are from Inwood, like Chicky Donahue telling this, you know, big dopey guy, go behind the bar and do your act, and you got to pick up some some good cash for doing it, and Sheila and all the other characters. I mean, you know, when I studied with Stella Adler, you know, her big thing to when I studied for a year with her, and when I didn't come back for the next year, she said, you just have to learn about life. That's what you need to do. You're going to be good, but you need to learn life. Well, what better place to learn life than Inwood? The plethora, the fiber of the characters and the people in Inwood, I just learned so much from them, and I've taken that with me everywhere I've gone. No, I think if I grew up in Valley Stream, I don't know, I'd be a plumber or something. I think Inwood made me everything. I no bones about it.
You're too big to be a plumber.
You're right. I couldn't fit under the sink.
There you go.
Before we go, is there anything else you want the audience to know about Steve McPartland?
You know, yeah, that I'm an incredibly grateful man. I think that when Father Jerry Travers, who's a Paulist priest, tapped me on the shoulder when I was 16 years old and told me I had to go upstairs and audition for a play because nobody did, and I was the president of the CYO and I had to get some of the guys up there because only girls were auditioning. And that's how I got the bug. To everything that's happened to me in my life, from meeting one person after another, who just always seemed to open a door for me and want to give me an opportunity, that actually led to a reasonably successful life in the entertainment and broadcasting field, and certainly has given me this great gift of having an incredibly interesting life. I am so thankful. I'm just probably I'm one of the most grateful people in the world, because it was really everything that I've done has been nothing but a gift. So I'm just grateful. That's what people should know about me. I'm very, very grateful for all the people who've been in my life and have just helped me.
Chick, what do you think? Do we have the complete story?
Yeah, he made my speech, though, except for the theatrical stuff. You know, I'm very grateful, just like Steve. And people open doors. And I often have discussions with guys about, listen, the best I can do is open the door. I'll introduce you to the guy. If I open the door, he'll know that I think you're an honest guy, and he'll give you a fair shake. But you got to dance. Once you get in there, you got to dance. So I got great, great satisfaction, and that's part of my thank yous. That's part of my being grateful. I love to help people. It's such a satisfying thing, and I'm grateful. Just like Steve, you remind you, that was my speech. I'm so grateful for all the people I met and all the people who have helped me get through a great life, a fantastic life, as its bumps and everything. But I'm one of the luckiest people in the world. I know that.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's been a real pleasure. And thank you, Chick, for joining in.
What? John, I feel like you. I can't remember the guy, Ralph Edwards. I feel like it was Steve McPartland. This is your life, bringing Chickie and Sheila in. So I want to thank you very much for that. And Chickie will have lunch next week. I'll give you a call.
Okay, buddy. Okay.
Thank you, buddy. Thanks, guys.
Thank you,
bye-bye.
John.
You too.
Okay. A bit of commercial information. My column now appears biweekly in the Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmacrants.com. That's JohnMacRants. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. Join me next week for my conversation with physicist and game developer William Volk, and as they say in the old neighborhood, CEO, whoa, Silva, ho, Silva, steady. Good night, Tom.
Good night, John. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night, all.